From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today on the show, we speak with the former mayor of Oklahoma City, who thinks the success of the country is linked to the success of mid-sized metropolitan areas.
Later, the stars of the Milwaukee Reps play Guards at the Taj say their roles are more than just an acting gig.
The play is so poetic. There's so much you can take with you. I mean, I still find moments while doing the play, make discoveries about humanity, about myself, about what beauty means to me, what does order mean to me.
And Stacy DeKaiser's new middle grade novel is based in part on her dad's stories of growing up and playing baseball at Milwaukee's Washington Park Zoo.
It was their playground. He was a city kid, and the park was where you played. And so he would just tell us stories about how they played ball between the buffalo pen and the mountain goat mountain. And if the ball went over the fence and into the animal's yard, somebody had to get it out.
Lake Effect is next. First, the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The history of almost every American city features a series of boom and bust cycles. Milwaukee in the 1950s was a bustling manufacturing metropolis, but the city's fortunes fell in subsequent decades, and while the downtown has made a recovery, other aspects of the city are still a work in progress.
It is a story Mick Cornett recognizes. Cornett served four terms as mayor of Oklahoma City from 2004 to 2018. That city was virtually on life support in the 1990s, but is a completely different place as a result of several key policy decisions and some specialized taxes voters approved there. Cornett believes it is a recipe other mid-sized metropolitan areas could follow as well. His new book is called The Next American City, and Mick Cornett joins us on the line. Welcome to Lake Effect.
Great to be on with you.
So I actually want to start this interview by asking you about the end of your book. How do you see the story of mid-sized metros and Oklahoma City in particular paralleling your own story? I mean, this is about reinvention, isn't it?
Well, it is. I went through a period of my life. I thought I had the greatest job in the world. It's what I always wanted to do growing up, and that was be a television sportscaster. And I was living the dream, and at some point, especially after the bombing that took place in Oklahoma City, and I just realized I wanted to do something different with the second half of my professional life. I was assigned to go cover City Hall, kind of fell in love with local government, felt like that's where a person could make a difference. And I left television, started my own business, ran for city council, and then ultimately served as four terms as the mayor. So, yeah, it's kind of been a reinvention, and I now that I'm not the mayor, I've got this book out, but I'm looking at, what adventure do I have left in me?
Well, and so when we look at cities like Oklahoma City and other cities its size, the Milwaukees of the world, but also the Buffaloes and other places, what you're really writing about is their ability to reinvent themselves.
Well, that's right. Everybody loves the rags-to-riches story, and almost every city out there is always evolving. You're either going one direction or the other. Oklahoma City's probably come as far as fast as any city in the country, but that's because it had a long way to go. I mean, you go back to 1990, and Oklahoma City probably had the worst economy in the country, and things are different now. And I watched some of my predecessors work, learned from them along the way, and then tried to, stand on their shoulders and move the city forward. But cities can't ever, think that they've solved an issue because, tomorrow there'll be new issues to solve and you got to keep moving. It's one of the frustrations of creating a city and a better city is that you never reach your destination. You've got to always keep planning and always keep inventing. And here's what's interesting to me, Mitch, going forward, is that over the next couple of decades, you're going to see these mid-sized cities like Oklahoma City and Milwaukee have great opportunities to attract the millennial generation and the generation coming in just behind it. And what it appears is that they are more attracted to cities that size than the big cities, New York, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. They want to be able to afford a house. They don't want to spend their hours in traffic congestion. They're looking for a better quality of life, a more urban environment, less auto-centric lifestyle. And that's where opportunities like Milwaukee and Oklahoma City have opportunities to kind of continue to plan purposely about what type of cities we want to have.
Right. You were talking about where Oklahoma City was, say, 25 or 30 years ago. For folks who haven't been there, can you kind of contrast what it looked like in 1990 or 95 with what it looks like today?
Yeah, it was desolate. I mean, the downtown core was just emptied out. After, I mean, there were some tall buildings. People worked there. But at 5 o'clock, when people went home, there was no nightlife. There was one hotel in downtown Oklahoma City, and it was struggling. Very few people lived downtown. There were no restaurants, no retail, and all of the life of the city was out of the suburbs. And we became a suburb of nothing, and the core was dying or was dead. And we had a business-minded mayor who realized we had to invest in ourselves. And so he passed an initiative that kind of started reinventing from a capital perspective in the inner city, amenities to bring people downtown. And it was a game-changing event. And ultimately, I think, even though, you know, even today, most people, you know, don't live downtown. A lot of people do, but most people don't. People generally care about their neighborhood, and they care about their downtown. There's an emotional attachment to the core of the city, and that's very important to get people to buy into some of the changes that are necessary. Because, you know, this highly educated 20-somethings, the group of people that I think all mid-sized cities are hoping to attract, they're highly selective. They're looking for a vibrant urban core. They want a walkable downtown and walkable entertainment districts and things to do. They want to be culturally relevant. And, you know, Milwaukee and a handful of other cities are set up to succeed if we do it right.
Right. So, I want to ask you about taxes, because I know you describe yourself as a small government conservative, and that seems pretty par for the course for Oklahoma. And yet it sounds like many of the successes Oklahoma City has claimed in the past couple of decades have come as a result of local government and sometimes business leaders being able to go to voters and making the case for raising money to do things. So, you know, what's the secret sauce? What's the argument that really resonates with people that makes them want to invest?
Well, I believe in efficient government and doing what you say you're going to do. And I think one of the success stories in Oklahoma City is that local government has developed a certain level of trust with the citizens. And we've largely used this taxation principle for capital structures. And people in Oklahoma City seem to have differentiated between the type of taxes they're willing to consider and the type they don't like. They like these capital programs where the taxation is for a certain number of years and then the tax will go away. We don't use debt in that type of funding formula. In other words, we collect the sales tax and then start the process of building these amenities. And so, you know, debt doesn't accumulate. And in a very conservative political environment, people in Oklahoma appreciate that aspect. But people just want, you know, they want their money's worth, and they want elected leaders who do what they say they're going to do. I mean, it's not complicated, but it's not universal. And I think that's one of the reasons that Oklahoma City has been so successful with its initiatives.
How important do you think it is for a mid-sized metro to have what basically amounts to a brand for itself, you know, to be known nationally or internationally for something or in some way?
Well, it's critical. And, you know, unfortunately, cities don't really control their brand or are not in complete control of their brand. You know, we had been branded by tragedy. When I was elected mayor in 2004, I used to travel and talk about Oklahoma City, and I could see on people's faces, the moment I said Oklahoma City, they had that image of the bombing from 1995. Then a tornado went through the edge of our city in 1999, and it was called the Oklahoma City Tornado. And so you have these horrific events that put a negative image on our brand. And so that's when I started going to the NBA and NHL offices in New York and starting talking to them about trying to get a major league city in Oklahoma City so that we could, a major league team in Oklahoma City, so we could start to work on our brand and get us associated with something positive. I mean, Milwaukee is well branded. I mean, through the decades, it's very strong in pop culture and people know it for different reasons. And that awareness is something that Milwaukee can build on and continues to.
Do you think our cities our size, Milwaukee's and Oklahoma City's and others, are they more susceptible to these boom and bust cycles that have happened over the years than New York or Los Angeles?
Well, probably, because maybe the economies are probably a little more similar. You know, you've you need to have a diversified economy to the extent you can. And in Oklahoma City, we spent 25 years trying to diversify, and it feels like we've finally done that. We had been such an oil and gas community for decades, and now we're invested in aviation and biomedical and tourism and things like that. So having a diversified economy is critical to avoiding the bust. You're always going to have the national economy being somewhat cyclical, too. So you don't need a local economy that's overly cyclical as well. I think that's critical, because if you go into any city and you look at the architecture and you look at the most important aspects of the built environment, generally they're built in the good times. And you can kind of look at architecture in a big city and kind of determine when they had their good times and when they didn't.
I'm curious whether this phenomenon exists in Oklahoma as well, and you'd be in a good position to kind of understand it. Is there a rural-urban divide that exists? I guess the question I have is whether, you need to bring the rest of the state in on ensuring the success or the success of its major metropolitan areas, and how you convince, rural Oklahoma that what's good for Oklahoma City is good for them, or in a place like Milwaukee, Milwaukee and rural Wisconsin.
Yeah, I think there's a rural-urban divide in almost every state in the country, and we've seen that in Oklahoma as well. There is a role that the big cities play, and there is a role for smaller and rural communities to play. And what we need, I think, at least part of the answer, and I'm not saying this is something that's easy to solve, but what we need is elected officials who are trying to bring people together. I think it's important that, we don't continue to divide up at every opportunity. We have so much partisan politics and so much divisiveness at the national level. At some point, we've got to come together, and hopefully that can be at the local level. And so people, regardless of whether they're urban or rural or whether they're Republicans or Democrats, can realize that our community, our state, is not going to go forward unless we get more people pulling on the same rope. But the funding at the state capitol, I know, is critical. And, on an annual basis, it seems like there's rural legislators and urban legislators who are fighting needlessly and not in the best interest of the state as a whole.
All right. So I am curious where you see the story of Oklahoma City's civic weight loss effort fitting in this bigger picture.
Well, that was an awareness campaign that I launched 10 years ago when we were showing up on the list of the most obese cities in the country. And I think as an awareness campaign, it's done a tremendous work. And now, here 10 years ago, we're seeing our health statistics in the city improve. So, that's been a journey that I learned a lot along the way and wrote about in the book. I think it's an example of how you can take something that's a negative statistic or a negative image or something that's tough to overcome, make it positive and try to make it in a whimsical way, something that people can rally around. I believe positive energy is important if you're going to institute change. And when you're talking about obesity, if it's hard to find positive energy, and we were able to do that.
There's something in the idea of leading by example as well.
Well, yes, I suppose so. And I've had people say that my own weight loss journey was a critical part of that story. And I suppose that's true. But, I think some things, require a conversation and some things we don't want to talk about. And I think obesity is one of those issues we're not comfortable talking about normally. And what I did was I went to the zoo and I stood in front of the elephants and I told the entire city I was putting them on a diet. And we were going to lose 1 million pounds. And sort of the whimsical nature of that, I think, put a positive spin on a very difficult issue. But it created a conversation. Suddenly you had a community that was talking about a very tough issue. And talking about it, obviously, is the first step in addressing it.
Mick Cornett is the former mayor of Oklahoma City. He fell short in his bid for governor this year. He's also the author of the new book, The Next American City, The Big Promise of Our Mid-Size Metros. And we should note that despite a lifetime of living in Oklahoma, he is a lifelong Green Bay Packers fan.
A short break now, and then we'll speak with two stars of a bloody good show with the Milwaukee Rep, a preview of Guards at the Taj when Lake Effect returns in a moment on Milwaukee's NPR. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. The new production at the Milwaukee Rep, Guards at the Taj, is less than 90 minutes long, but that's plenty of time for the two-person show to cover plenty of ground. The play, which features two men standing guard before the Taj Mahal is revealed to the public, is at turns funny, biting, thought-provoking, and a little, sometimes a lot, bloody.
The play was written by award-winning playwright Rajiv Joseph and considers what happens when ordinary people are caught up in difficult circumstances with difficult demands of them. The Rep production stars Awais Ahemmet and Yusuf Sultani, who joined us in the studio recently and talked about the nature of mixing humor with uncomfortable situations.
I think it's the point. The thing is, dark comedies appeal to me so much because they're a mirror of actual life. Your actual life, in one day, you can go through an emotional roller coaster of things that happen to you. You know, you're going to be laughing one second and during your day, and then you hear some tragic news about something that happens on TV, and then, you know, you're grief-stricken. And this play is very much like that in the sense that you'll be laughing completely and hysterically, and then the next moment, it's like someone punched you in the gut, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Is there a challenge as an actor to doing that in a way that, I don't know, do you want to feel manipulative or not? If that's a fair question to ask.
Well, you know, our jobs as actors can sometimes be really difficult because you have to be really present. And in order to serve the text really well with its full intentions, even we have to be really present to the moment that's coming up and not think about it. So it comes as a surprise to us because the audience, I feel, is another character itself. So they are another character in the play that's listening and interacting with us, and they're going on this journey with us. And as we're making discoveries, they're making discoveries. And that part's where Yosef is talking about, where we get punched in the gut, that happens to us, and the visceral reaction hopefully will transcend to the audience as well.
Well, I always wonder about this when you have actors and they're doing a play that is funny, and you're doing it night in, night out over the course of the run of the show. It really you really have to be in a position where it still feels as natural to mm-hmm. you the 15th time you've done it as it did the first and the second.
Oh yeah, during rehearsals we play with it consistently. We'll have to stop because we make each other laugh in the middle of the scene. So during a performance run, I think you continue to find new things after each performance. You'll surprise yourself, as you should. You know, the journey doesn't end until the curtain closes on the final night. And I really believe that it starts from the first day of rehearsal to the final day. So you'll never have you'll have a finished product, but at the same time, that product is always evolving. So things that are funny one night might land for the audience, and we find it funny, but it might not, and that's okay. The moments change, and the dynamic shifts between scenes consistently. You're never going to have the same show, and that's the great part about live theater.
Does your timing change based on the reaction of the audience?
I believe so. Yes,
it's going to. If somebody laughs in the audience, and you have to pause for that, then you know you have to pause for laughter.
And if there's a matinee crowd that's very enthusiastic compared to the night crowd, we'll have to play with them. But
Are matinee crowds more enthusiastic?
No, that was me being a little sarcastic.
Oh, okay.
You didn't pick up on that? Yeah, we'll have to. He's a good actor, I promise you. Really...
This is true.
Well, no, you're such a good actor that I believed you.
Thank you, Mitch. Thank you. Just wait till you see me doing the play. Yep.
This sounds like as good a time as any to actually hear you do a quick scene from the play.
Absolutely. Great.
Okay, so just briefly, in this one scene, it's a great contrast of what's actually happening because we're in the act of cleaning up all of the blood, and it's this really tragic, depressing scene to watch. But then the content of our actual conversation is hilarious, so it's a nice juxtaposition of what's happening on stage. And in this moment right now, they're talking about inventions. Your flying invention with the seatbelt? That was a good idea. I, too, have an invention. I have an invention, too. A transportable hole. It's literally a hole you can take anywhere with you. And anything you attached it to would suddenly have a hole in it. Say you wanted to go through a wall? You could. Or say you're trapped in a dungeon. Or you're in the desert and it's so hot. Hole in the ground? Now you can sleep in some shade. Also, there would be things to eat inside the hole.
What would there be to eat?
I don't know. Beef curry? paratas.
It wouldn't fall out?
What?
Food wouldn't fall out of the hole?
No, it would be in the hole.
But the hole's a hole.
A transportable hole.
How do you carry it?
Carry what?
The transportable hole.
It would have a sack.
A sack?
Inside the sack, transportable hole.
What if I were in the sack?
Why would you be in the sack?
For example, if I was?
It's not a very big sack. You wouldn't fit.
It's a small sack.
Big enough only for the transportable hole.
It's a small hole?
Small enough to fit in the sack, but then, as holes are, it could grow and shrink in size.
But what if I were in the sack?
You wouldn't be in this. As I've said, it's a small sack.
Say I was very small.
Suddenly, you are very small.
Yes.
Small enough to fit inside the sack.
Yes, I'm trapped, see? Inside the sack.
How did you shrink?
There was a potion from some witch.
Okay.
So now I'm very small, and someone has gone and put me inside the sack.
With the transportable hole.
No, the transportable hole isn't there yet. It's out of the sack.
You took it out of the sack?
I didn't take it out. It was already out when I was captured and put in the sack.
Who took it out?
The boss man who owns it?
Maybe the emperor.
You would think the emperor.
Seeing as the transportable hole is probably a very rare and expensive thing.
That's what I was thinking. Not everyone gets a transportable hole. Too many transportable holes would be a bad idea, as they might take up everything. The whole world. And then what? What if everything was a hole? I have another invention, too, which is for something you put inside the clouds.
Wait, go back to when you're inside the sack.
Oh, yes, because I've shrunken to a very small size.
How small? Like a child?
No, like a doll a child plays with.
That's very small. And you're in the sack.
Trapped inside because the boss man, probably the emperor, captured me and put me in there.
Punished for being too small.
But because the sack I'm in is also the sack to transport the transportable hole is now put in the sack with me. Now, I'm in a sack that has a hole in it. So, can I escape?
Well, you could just go right through the hole.
Exactly.
That's what the hole is for.
But could the transportable hole, wouldn't it also fall through its own hole?
Could the hole fall through itself?
It's a good question.
Sure, it could.
Well, if it could, then the sack isn't a very good sack with which to carry it.
That is true.
Nothing could carry it.
Nothing could ever carry it.
Then how do you take the hole places?
You couldn't. Nobody could. It's a useless invention.
Unless you had two sacks, and the hole simply led to the other sack. So even if the hole did fall through itself, it would end up in the other sack, and then back again in the corresponding sack, like an hourglass. Yeah.
This is like Abbott and Costello clean up blood in front of the Taj Mahal.
Totally.
Basically.
We should talk a little bit about the play itself. I mean, the two of you are playing Imperial Guards. They're posted in front of the just about to open Taj Mahal. And at the heart of the play is this long-standing story about the people who built the Taj.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
In that, in so much as the emperor who ordered the Taj made decided or decreed that nothing would ever be as beautiful as the Taj, and thus. I'll let you fill in the story from there.
Well, it's a legend. It's a myth. And the story's been passed down for generations. And the amazing playwright, Rajiv Joseph, went to the Taj and he'd heard these things. And I saw this interview where he'd written this amazing play with lots of different characters. And it was a fully completed, realized play. And then they were staging it, and was workshopping it, and then he was, while watching it, fixated on these two guards in the corner who were actually having a conversation during rehearsal. And he was like, "That whatever's happening right there is so much more interesting than what's happening on stage right now. I'm going to scrap this whole thing and write a play about these two guys and then base it around this myth, this legend of how Emperor Shah Jahan decreed that nothing so beautiful as Taj Mahal shall ever be built again." And in this myth—
Yes, he ordered the 20,000 workers to never build anything as beautiful again. And according to myth, that people say that he ordered the hands to be cut off. Now, I was just at the Taj in India, actually, and my tour guide was telling me the story, and I was like, yeah, I know. And he's like, but do you know the same root word for taking hands is also writing? And I was like, oh. So he was like, yes, actually, what happened was they made people sign contracts that they will never work again and never build something as beautiful as the Taj Mahal. So from that transpired this
cutting off
this
hands,
this myth of like that again. He ordered the hands to be cut off. which I think is a fun myth because my grandma and my mom used to tell me that. And they'd be like, at the end, actually, it didn't really happen. I was like, well, then why are you scaring us?
Princess Bride. Right.
But like with many myths, there is this grain of truth, or it became a myth because there was something at its heart that actually did happen.
Right. Yes.
Yeah.
What do you think people are going to be asking themselves as they walk out of this play?
Well, hopefully they leave with a sense of, basically the play itself is the relationship of these two guys. It's friendship. But ultimately in current world, our zeitgeist right now, I think it deals a lot with the relationships between ordinary people and authority. Now, that's a big struggle in this play. And that's the difference between these two characters. One of them very much wants to be within this box and these rules and follow the rules and pleasing authority. And the other one's more, into inventions and the outward view of things of the world and its correlation with him as a being. It's things that have a little bit more weight to it, in my opinion.
These guys could be concentration camp guards. They could be foot soldiers in Rwanda. Or they could be
two regular guys. Yeah. Yes. I think that's the best part about this play is that anybody who comes to see this show can really relate to these characters. They're incredibly emphatic and sympathetic.
The play is so poetic. There's so much you can take with you. I mean, I still find moments while doing the play, make discoveries about humanity, about myself, about what beauty means to me, what does order mean to me. And the play also deals a lot with masculinity. What does it mean to be a man? What does it mean to be in touch with your emotions? How much of that are you told to shove out in the rug? And where do these ideas come from? So yeah, it's a really poignant play. And I'm excited to share this play and this work with the Milwaukee audiences.
Had you already gotten this role when you visited the Taj?
Yes. I found out I was doing the role, and I wanted to see the Taj Mahal before I started it. So I impulsively, which costs a lot of money,
right? This is not like an impulse buy at 7-Eleven.
No. I wish it cost as much, but I didn't. But it was beautiful there. It was totally worth it.
And have you been?
I have not, no. We talked about going together and, I was still in the process. It was only a 2-week span. So the fact that he made that happen, I'm pretty impressed and admiring of the fact that he was out there. We FaceTimed while he was there.
Yes.
And the morning he woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and it was, I guess it was about like 10 o'clock at night.
I woke up at 5, actually, to get there.
It was beautiful.
See it at dawn?
Yeah.
Ugh. It's gorgeous.
I mean, and I just saw it off an iPhone. It was in the background, and I saw his beautiful face, and it was joyous. I could see the elation on his face, and I felt the passion that he felt seeing it through him, and it was a beautiful thing that he was able to FaceTime me. But yeah, that experience, the fact that he came with that kind of experience already under his belt is pretty amazing.
Hey, when we do the show on Broadway, we'll have to go before we do that show.
Yeah, maybe the theater will pay for it.
Yeah. It's going to be Broadway. Of course they're going to pay for it.
A 2-week span, the jet lag alone makes that a staggering achievement.
You have no idea. Oh yeah. My gosh, jet lag's real. I haven't gone overseas in 15 years, and jet lag kicked my butt.
He got back Sunday, and then we started rehearsals Tuesday. So he was right, like he's fresh off of the plane having just seen Taj Mahal.
I looked like a mess. People were like, no, you look fine. And I was like, no, this is one of those moments where I actually look like a mess.
Who told you look fine?
People said it very politely. Hey, I see what you did there.
Well, listen, it is a terrific play, and the two of you are wonderful representatives of it sitting here in the studio with
me.
I am honored to have you both here, and thanks so much.
Thanks, Mitch.
Owais Ahemmet and Yusuf Saltani star as Babun and Hamayun in Rajiv Joseph's Guard at the Taj, which runs through November 4th at the Milwaukee Rep. You'll find more information at wuwm.com, and we'd be remiss if we didn't point out that the playwright Rajiv Joseph's other works include a play called The Lake Effect.
Another break now, and then as we savor the Brewers' division-clinching win over the Cubs yesterday, a new book for young readers takes us back to a much earlier era for baseball in Milwaukee. This is Lake Effect from WUWM. Lake Effect continues on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mitch Tite.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Before the Brewers of 2018 won the National League's Central Division, they were longtime members of the American League. But before they were in the American League, another version of the Brewers played in the minor leagues at a long-departed stadium called Borchert Field. It's a fictionalized version of those Brewers who play a role in a recent middle grade novel by Milwaukee native Stacy DeKaiser.
The book tells the story of a young first-generation American living in the Milwaukee of the 1940s. He's the son of Greek immigrants, and his hope of hopes is to compete in a contest being sponsored by the baseball team. But alas, the contest is on a Saturday, the day he is expected to work in his father's shop. The book is called The Rhino in Right Field, and Stacy DeKaiser joins us in the studio. Welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
So what was it that so captured your imagination about your dad's childhood in Milwaukee that it turned into this story?
I think the stories he told were so preposterous that if I didn't know my dad, I wouldn't believe them. I did know that he grew up a couple blocks from the Washington Park Zoo in the 1940s, and it was their playground. He was a city kid, and the park was where you played. And so he would just tell us stories about how they played ball between the buffalo pen and Mountain Goat Mountain, and if the ball went over the fence and into the animal's yard, somebody had to get it out. And I realized that it would make a great book, so it was a good jumping off point for.
Well, and you know, that's the thing. You knew your dad, and you knew that even though these stories sounded preposterous, there was at least a fair amount of truth to them. The kids that read this might think it's preposterous, and if they keep reading the author's note, they find out that actually this is based in truth.
Yeah, I think that's what drew me too, is that modern day kids today don't know what it's like to have a zoo literally in your backyard, and so. There is sort of a tall tale element to this story, which I sort of helped along by adding a few pretty preposterous elements that are completely fictional, but that's kind of the fun of the story. And it just sort of blossomed from there.
I am fascinated by this concept of practicing baseball in a zoo. This is something they did a lot?
Well, my dad did it a lot. So growing up, I thought it was a perfectly normal and natural thing to do. Whether, you know, I don't know how representative that is, but it was his reality. And so I just thought that was just a really great setting for a story. So.
The Washington Park Zoo, we should mention, I mean, is now the Milwaukee County Zoo and is out at where the county zoo is on Blue Mound Road.
Right.
But it was a zoo of a much different nature when it was in Washington Park, a little more open.
Because it was part of the city park, there were no fences or gates and no admission fee or anything like that. And it was open year round, at least ostensibly it was. I mean, in the winter, a lot of the animals were housed indoors. But I think some of those buildings you could still go into in the winter. And I think that probably was an even better place to play in the winter because it was sort of like no one was there except the kids. And the vestiges of the zoo are still there. And I think that's one of the things that fascinated me most when I did research for this book was my dad, who's still very much alive and kicking, took me for a tour of his old neighborhood. And we paced out the park and there are still vestiges of the zoo there.
For example, I know we've chatted with the zoo librarian a little bit about this, and I know she played a role in helping you do research for this book as well.
She did. She really sparked my interest because I visited her, and I was like my book geek self was like totally amazed that there is such a thing as a library at the zoo. So that was very cool in the first place. But then she pulled out just tons and tons of photos of the old Washington Park Zoo. And we went through this treasure trove of photos. And I had my dad with me, actually. So he was able to sort of give me live commentary and point out in the picture, say, this is where the ball field was. This is where the sledding hill was. And so after we looked through those pictures, we went to Washington Park and we walked around. And he showed me where the fence was for the buffalo. Field, and it's still there. The retaining wall is still there. The wrought iron fence is still there, and he demonstrated how he could still climb over the fence without breaking his neck. Thank goodness. But so it was pretty cool. Yeah.
You didn't throw a baseball in just for
no, because I didn't want to encourage him any more than he was already doing. So
Paint a picture of the broader Milwaukee neighborhood that you capture in this book.
Yeah, my dad was the son of Greek immigrants. So growing up, he was sort of a lot like Nick in the book. He was kind of caught between two cultures and between two worlds. And I tried to imagine what that must have been like for a kid growing up to be part of a very close-knit Greek community, but a very old world sort of community that was struggling to assimilate and fit into American culture. And while the fictional Nick and my real dad, I think, were very much, they felt very loved and very supported in their Greek community, they were, I think, very much wishing to be nothing more than an all-American kid.
Right. They're forging their own American identity.
Yeah. It was interesting to explore just that thought in this book and to see what it must be like for a 12-year-old kid to try and find his own identity. And for the character in the book, the one thing that more than anything else that would define his Americanness was baseball. And so he enters a bat boy contest, and he wants to win that more than anything. Yeah.
And we should note that the baseball team is at least loosely based on what was then the minor league team that called Milwaukee home.
Right. It's based on the minor league Brewers, and I did change their name to the Mud Puppies just to avoid confusion. But the baseball park is at 8th and Chalmers, which is 8th and Chambers in Milwaukee. The owner of the team is based on the real life owner of the Brewers in the 1940s, who was Bill Veeck, who was a very colorful character and very influential in professional baseball to this day. And it was fascinating just to delve into his story and incorporate him into the book. He's legendary and deserves a lot more attention than I think he's gotten, even more than he's gotten in the past. Yeah.
Well, and the team plays in the book at Orchard Field, which is of course based on Borchardt Field.
Right.
Yes.
Yeah. So I took a few liberties, but if you know Milwaukee at all, you know that it's not a very well disguised Milwaukee in the book. Yeah.
The other story that you managed to weave into this book is the existence at the time of the All-American Girls Professional Baseball League as well.
Right. It's funny. Yeah. One of my favorite movies is A League of Their Own. And my kids who are in their 20s now say, "Oh, Mom, that's such an old movie." I'm like, "What?
Isn't that painful?"
Yeah, it's very painful. But so it's funny that kids these days probably aren't that familiar with that movie, but which sort of delves into a similar topic. So one thing I uncovered while I was researching this book, especially Bill Veeck's life, was that when he moved on to Cleveland and was owner of the Cleveland Indians, he did sponsor a bat boy contest. And it was strictly an essay contest. He invited boys aged 12 to 16 to submit essays. And according to a biography that I read, among the thousands of essays contributed, one essay was sent in by a girl. Only one was sent in by a girl. And that girl got a letter telling her why she was not eligible to participate. And that just blew me away, just to think of how just because of your gender, you're denied participation in something as innocuous as playing baseball. And it stuck with me. And so this girl character showed up, and this was the girl who really wanted to join the baseball contest. And I realized that it was a great opportunity to sneak in the girls' baseball league and talk about how girls can participate in certain things. But in the 1940s, there was a bit of a barrier. And it was fun including those details about the short skirts and the required lipstick and things like that.
And of course, the irony to the bat boy contest that, you know, she can't enter because, you know, girls aren't supposed to play baseball is that the kinds of things that the kids have to do to compete in the bat boy contest, aside from write an essay, have almost nothing to do with baseball. Except
right.
Maybe sunflower seed spitting.
Right. Yeah. And that was a lot of fun, too, because I wanted it to be, you know, figuratively speaking, a level playing field for these kids. And I mean, my main character, Nick, is not a very good baseball player, but I wanted the reader to think that he might have a chance of winning this contest. And the only way to do that was to, to sort of throw them a curve and have the competition be really nothing about baseball.
That was a good baseball metaphor anyway.
Yeah, thank you very much. Yeah.
This is probably as good a time as any to hear maybe just a little bit from the book. And I think you're going to start with where all of your readers will start.
Yeah, chapter one. Here we go. Everything started on the day I had that close call with Tank. Tank lives two blocks away, so I see him almost every day, but he usually ignores me. This is probably for the best, since Tank is a rhinoceros, a 2,580-pound Diceras bicornis with a 17-inch horn, according to the sign on his fence. That fence also happened to be our right field fence, which is how Tank and I got to know each other on a first-name basis. It was my turn to play right field, and I'll admit it, my mind wandered. If you've ever played baseball, you know what it's like, because nobody ever hits the ball to right field. Except, of course, when they do. It doesn't help that I'm a terrible outfielder. To be perfectly honest, I couldn't catch a fly ball to save my life. So there I was, caught flat-footed when Pete walloped the ball. It sailed over my head and landed with a thunk in a pile of hay on the wrong side of the fence. Tank side. And there was Tank snoozing in the shade of a billboard. Call King's Motors at Hopkins 5800, your source for genuine Packard parts. That was our last baseball. Somebody had to get it back. And that somebody was a right fielder. Let me say this right now. The general public does not belong in rhinoceros pens, ever. This fact is so obvious, some genius decided that a stone wall topped with a chest-high chain-link fence would be enough of a reminder. Sure, it's enough to keep a stumpy-legged rhino in, but it's useless at keeping a 12-year-old kid out. Because here's another obvious thing. Baseballs do not belong in rhinoceros pens either. What if Tank ate the ball? That would end the game in a hurry, or at least postpone it. The truth always comes out in the end, so to speak. The fellas gave me their usual encouragement. What are you waiting for, Nick? I think he's chicken, that's what I think. Some right fielder you are. What are you, scared of a little old rhino? I dropped my mitt and sized up the situation. Hopped the fence, grabbed the ball, back to safety. 6 seconds, tops. Or never, depending on the reflexes of the rhino. Yep, he's chicken all right. Bawk, bawk, bawk. I took a deep breath, wound myself up, and vaulted the fence up and over. Attaboy, Nick! Raced to the hay pile. Hurry up! Grabbed the ball. That's not the ball. What is that? There's the ball. Snort. Run! Don't look back! Over the top and out. Exactly 2,580 pounds of muscle crashed into the wall behind me, leaving a tank-shaped dent in the stone. I might be making up that last part, but everything else is true, I swear. I somersaulted on the ground. My heart was pounding. My pants were torn. Something smelled really bad. But I was holding the ball. You did it, said Ace, running out from shortstop. Holy moly, we thought you were a goner, hollered Charlie from the pitcher's mound. Chuck just stood there in left field with his mouth hanging open. Look at you, Spirakis. Here came Pete, swaggering out from home plate with a bat on his shoulder. You might live to finish sixth grade after all. Now grab your mitt and hand over that muddy ball. That was a home run, and it's 4-3. Still two outs. I stood up, brushed myself off, and flipped the ball to Pete. Not so fast, slugger. You know the rules. Anything hit into the rhino pen is an automatic out. Oh, and by the way, that ain't mud. Chapter one.
Has your dad read this book?
Yes, he's read the book. I think he might have read it. He might have read it 3 or 4 times already. I gave it to him before it was published because at the time I was researching and writing the book, I never really told him what I was doing, although he knew what I was doing because I kept asking him all these questions like, Dad, what was the name of that store on the corner where your mom used to send you to get pork chops? And I would ask him all these crazy questions. So he knew something was up. And I gave the book to him before it was published because I wanted him to know that I changed some things. And I said, this is your childhood, but it's not. And I don't want you to be surprised at the liberties I took with your childhood. And so he was prepared and he has given me his thumbs up. And so he's okay with me changing some facts of his life.
Has to be something for him, though, to have his childhood represented in the character.
Yeah, I think he thinks it's pretty cool. He won't admit it. He's not a very effusive kind of guy, but yeah.
Do you feel any closer to him for having done this, gone through this process?
Well, yes and no. I mean, I've always been pretty close to my dad, and so, but it is very special. I never really thought I would write something so close to my actual history and life as well as his, since it is my life too in a way. So I never thought I'd write something so personal, and I wouldn't have guessed it might have been about my dad, but I'm glad it is. I think it's pretty appropriate, yeah.
Stacy DeKaiser's new middle grade novel is called The Rhino in Right Field. DeKaiser is a Milwaukee native, but she now lives in Connecticut. You'll find a link to her website from ours at wuwm.com.
Coming up next, Radio Chipstone introduces us to a visual and textile artist from Colombia. Lake Effect returns with that in a moment on 89.7 WUWM.
More of Lake Effect Now here on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Luisa Fernanda Garcia is a recent graduate of the UW-Madison Textiles Fashion and Design Program. However, that's not necessarily where she got her start. That process began at home in Colombia, where she studied industrial design. From there, she moved to Paris and studied at Paris 8 while simultaneously working at Elle magazine.
Garcia says fitting her Latina body into the world of the European aesthetic was a challenge, pushing her to develop her own standards of beauty. Her experiences in the fast pace of the industry as both student and production assistant were vital and helped her to create her own fashion company, Mom Puxino.
In this edition of Radio Chipstone, Garcia tells contributor Jennifer Fields that just because she doesn't play the hardcore game of the fashion industry doesn't mean she isn't interested in the game. Garcia says her goal is to make sure all the players are treated well, valued, and paid a fair wage.
I moved to the U.S. and I decided to just create this shoe company. And then this shoe company was highlighting like a handmade goods. So how to come back to the handmade process, how like a we are this kind of like in this super industrialized world and how like these small touches start getting lost, you know, the idea of the mistakes also change, you know, mistakes also creates personality, you know. No one is imperfect. No one is perfect and no one is imperfect, both sides, you know. So how I can create that? So we decided to, me and, you know, I had this, I have a, someone that started this business with me as a shoemaker in Minneapolis, and the way was to just create like a small batches in United States that then is going to be produced in also like a industrial small batches for artisans in Colombia. So, you know, for me to come back to Colombia, not just only because those are my roots, but it was also because like at that time, the globalization about textiles and shoemaking and homemade goods was completely like a taking over. So we had these people that had been doing this for centuries, you know, and they come in like a small batches, but still like a, the hands get tired, people get tired. And there's like a how affect the production of the object itself. So I think that coming back to your question was like a, how is like a, the responsibility about, you know, we're humans doing stuff with our hands and it's been that for centuries. How they can be competitive, how they can go also being like an exquisite product or whatever it is. Also how we can treat better makers. And when you work with artists and it's not like I'm imposing my thoughts over them, it's always a come and back, a communication about skills and techniques. So this is what I know, and you know this, and you're a master on this, and I'm trying to be a master on that.
So let's share.
Exactly. So I think like I think the way that I try to, you know, like yes, I try to get in many angles about how I can make this idea of fashion a different way, like how like you can empower people just feeling like a glow person without this, don't really get related about what your body looks like. It's more like how you feel and how the pieces can express. Also how like I can, in terms of production, how I can be like fair and how I can make like people not only paying fairly about their work, but also feeling good about their techniques. You know, there is aesthetic, of course, and there is there. But I think that somehow I'm very involved about community and women empowering and how we can stand up and how in my own ways, you know, as a designer, I can do that. I'm not a social worker, I'm not a psychologist, I don't know anything about this, but I know I have social consciousness, and that's what I want to do. This is the way that I see life, so.
So, Luisa, I often hear people talking about, you know, I would buy more handmade things, but they cost so much money. And I always say to them, so why do you think somebody should suffer for your pleasure?
you are like a putting another person down to empower your own ego. And that is not okay. I hear about that. It costs the double. That is something the machines make. But humans are alive. Machines are not. And then also there is something exquisite about when the piece is handmade. I love to know about how the piece is being made. I get excited about the sewing part. I love the mistakes. Even it makes me crazy. It's beautiful. It reminds me that someone put their own hand energy into that garment. You know what I mean? I'm getting something from someone.
You get to see the hand of the maker.
Exactly. Mostly of these handmade techniques is not just because, just a needle and a thread. It's also ancestral. You know, it's been for centuries. It's part of culture, you know. Somehow, it's kind of do something that is handmade. It's also have time for yourself to meditate, to think, you know, when you are doing a piece that it takes you 4 hours doing the same technical part, you know, a stitching, embroidery, for instance, or weaving. And somehow it kind of creates this kind of meditation. And, you know, and then it's being around, I want to know, you know, when you want to know about how your mom cooked a chicken, you know, it's the same. I want to know what my ancestors did for the past 5 centuries. I want to keep them alive. I want to, you know, this is rich. It's culture. It's knowledge. What are we going to step out of that? You know, it's beautiful. I have in 2 masters. I have 4 degrees. And I could fly a plane, but I didn't know. I could do it, but I don't, you know. I can operate someone, but I don't, you know. It doesn't matter about, this is not what it matters to me. What it matters to me is how I can make a better society, how we can make a better communities and philosophical ways to understand the world without don't scratch anyone and being happy and also make myself happy. You know, that's what I'm doing, what I do, you know, but I need to find the angle in which I can marriage these 2 ideas.
Material culture contributor Jennifer Fields curates the Radio Chipstone series. The project is funded by the Chipstone Foundation, a decorative arts foundation whose mission is preserving and interpreting their collection, as well as stimulating research and education in the decorative arts.
For this episode, Jennifer spoke with Luisa Fernanda Garcia, founder and owner of Mompoxino, a fashion company that makes and sells handmade shoes and leather goods. That's all for today's edition of the show. I'm Mitch Tyke.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I hope you can be with us again tomorrow at 10 for another Lake Effect on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee's NPR.
Keep listening. It's 11 o'clock, and fresh air is next.